What then must we do? Straight talk about the next American Revolution. Democratizing wealth and building a community-sustaining economy from the ground up. By Garl Purovitz. Chapter 6, An Initial Way to Think About System Change. Let me begin by telling you a tale my father once told me about his first day at college, and then a real-life story about history and prehistory and changing the system, maybe. My father was an engineer. He entered the University of Wisconsin at age 16 in 1924, and he loved to recall his first professor of engineering, a gruff, mustachioed, white-haired, detail-demanding Germanic hardliner. At least, so he stands my childhood memory. The very first day, across the entire front of the 1924 classroom, this, of course, was pre-PowerPoint, our professor had unscrolled a huge picture of a giant locomotive, the kind we no longer know about or see, the kind with dozens of wheels, smoke pouring out the smokestack, and massive power bursting forth on all sides. The task for the entering freshman class? We will redesign this entire locomotive. How to proceed? We begin today with one bolt. Yes, I'm suggesting we start breaking down the system problem, both in general and in connection with the how do we get from here to there question. We will, of course, have to assemble the bolts in due course, but I find it helps to start with very concrete realities. Accordingly, on to that story I mentioned at the outset about history and prehistory, and maybe changing the system. Many years ago, in 1977, a very large steel mill was closed down on one very unhappy September day in the city of Youngstown, Ohio. 5,000 workers lost their job, their livelihoods, and their futures when Youngstown Sheet and Tube went down. 5,000 on one day was a very big deal, nationally, in 1977. It made the front page of newspapers and was the top story on the evening news. The reason being, this had not happened very often in the United States of America up to that point. Now, tragically, it is hardly news, since it happens all the time. That is another feature of the systemic crisis. The steelworkers, back in 1977, called it Black Monday, and I remember all too well how, as the reality sank in, we heard reports of men who could no longer support their families going out into the garage and putting a pistol to their heads. That was not the only response, however. One young steelworker named Gerald Dickey somehow got to thinking that there was no reason the steelworkers themselves couldn't run this facility, and he began to urge and organize and push and shove to get some interest in his outrageous idea. Just to give you an idea of what outrageous meant in Youngstown, Dickey was taken aside by one of the town's leading businessmen and advised in a very fatherly manner, "If you're interested in steel mills, let me suggest a couple stocks you might buy." But, of course, Dickey and others had a somewhat different idea, and they, along with many others, began to get serious. First, they got a number of their activist friends who worked at the mill together. Second, they found that a group of Youngstown religious leaders were also upset because if the huge mill went down, a good part of the economy and the livelihood of the community would go down. Third, the steelworkers in a new ecumenical coalition, headed by a Catholic and an Episcopal bishop, began to demand that the mill be put back to work under some form of worker or worker community ownership. Fourth, they found a sympathetic ear in one Washington bureaucrat, an assistant secretary of housing and urban affairs named Bob Embry, and suddenly they had enough money to finance a real professional plan for how to put the old mill back into operation with the latest modern technology. I was called in to help oversee the development of the plan, and to help advise on other matters. All this now seems like only yesterday, especially because, as we shall see, lots more folks are doing this kind of thing now. Long story short, the young steelworkers and the ecumenical coalition were very sophisticated about what they were taking on. They knew their only chance against the big steel companies, all of which were less than enthusiastic about the idea of workers owning mills, to say the least, was to build a popular political base around the state and, to the extent feasible, around the nation. This meant capitalizing on the bold tale of workers taking on the big guys and drawing in the press, and also mobilizing the national religious community. By the way, they also had to take on national union leadership. The United Steelworkers in 1977 also had absolutely no interest in the idea of workers owning a mill, and indeed thought of the young steelworkers in Youngstown as upstart troublemakers who might also perhaps one day cause problems for the established national leadership. A major victory occurred. The Carter administration studied their plan and agreed to allocate at least $100 million in loan guarantees to put it into operation. You will not be surprised to learn, however, that though they won the first major battles, the Youngstown steelworkers and the ecumenical coalition lost the war. Somehow, Oddly, just after the midterm elections of 1978 were over and the national politicians no longer had to worry about a backlash, the Carter administration's interest faded away, and the $100 million never quite got allocated. And, somehow, oddly, the major steel corporations and the Steelworkers Union, it was rumored, were, somehow, maybe involved, though, of course, no one could prove anything. Why, you might ask, are we starting off this chapter with a total fiasco, a major loss, and a profound tragedy? We do not know how many workers went out to the garage as the stark realities became increasingly clear. The answer is, the story did not end there. And if you're interested in systemic change, rather than token politics, the next steps are perhaps of greater significance. They are also instructive, particularly about what it takes and how maybe to think about change in a different way. Neither the young steelworkers nor the ecumenical coalition were naive. They knew they were up against some of the most powerful corporate and, at the time, union players in the country. They were fully aware that they might well lose the battle. They also knew, however, that they were on to a very important idea, one whose time, they hoped, would one day come no matter what. Why should workers not own the companies in which they work? They kept asking. Why can't this become an idea to put into everyday practice, now or in the future? Accordingly, as part and parcel of their strategy, they made it their business to help educate the public and the press and the politicians in the state and around the country about what they were trying to do both locally and in a much more fundamental sense as a larger national strategy and vision. Once again, long story short, the Youngstown story did not, in fact, die when the Carter administration turned its back on the workers in 1978. Instead, the inspiring example of the workers and the ecumenical coalition, plus the very sophisticated educational and political work they did to spread the word, had an ongoing impact. There are now many, many worker-owned businesses in the state of Ohio, and the support system for building them is one of the best in the nation. There is also a very energetic Ohio Employee Ownership Center at Kent State University that provides assistance to workers and others who want to establish such firms. The center was put together by a Kent State professor, the late John Logue, who was directly and personally inspired by the Youngstown effort. And the simple idea that workers can and should own their own factories or stores or other businesses is an idea that is now almost conventional in many parts of Ohio, not only among workers but also among businessmen, many of whom, aided by certain tax benefits, now sell their successful businesses to their former employers when they retire. That last paragraph compresses roughly 30 years into 5 sentences. So, obviously, there's a lot more to the tale. I'm sure you get the general point, or points, however, except that, in fact, things start to get even more interesting if we go down the track just a bit farther. It is not simply that the idea of worker ownership is now pretty much commonplace in various parts of the state. Something else has happened. The concept has gotten much more sophisticated as time has gone on, and as people have thought about things and worked on them in different ways. Innovation has also occurred. And as a result of work done in the last several years, there now exists in Cleveland a group of very sophisticated worker-owned companies linked together with a community-building nonprofit corporation and a revolving fund designed to help create more and more such linked community-building cooperative businesses as time goes on. Furthermore, part of the new design involves getting big hospitals and universities in the area, like Cleveland Clinic, Case Western Reserve University, and University Hospitals, to agree to purchase some part of their needs from the worker-owned companies. The goal now is not simply worker ownership, but worker ownership linked to a community-building strategy, and supported in part by larger institutions that not only have broad interest in the community, but also are dependent in part on public programs supported by the workers and the community's tax dollars, such as Medicare, Medicaid, and educational funds. Put another way, the process that can be traced to the Youngstown effort, including its seeming failure, has also led to innovation and further development and greater sophistication. As time has passed, new priorities and another set of alliances have begun to develop. Now, all of the linked worker-owned companies are very, very green by design. For instance, the Evergreen Cooperative Laundry operates out of a LEED gold-certified building and uses and has to heat around one-third the amount of water that other commercial laundries use in heat. Evergreen Energy Solutions is poised to install twice as much solar capacity in the coming period than currently exists in the entire state of Ohio. And Green City Growers Cooperative, a 3.25-acre hydroponic greenhouse, the largest in any American city, currently produces some 3 million heads of lettuce a year, along with hundreds of thousands of pounds of herbs. Two new cooperative businesses are scheduled to come online each year as the building processes continue. By the way, local businessmen have been helpful in all this. The overall effort builds consumers, helps the local economy, and supports the tax base, and thereby all local businesses as well. Many also feel good about doing something for the community, and the politics of this seems to work too. The mayor, as of this writing, Frank Jackson, looks very, very good in the press. Just for the hell of it, I suggest you go back one chapter to the introduction to this part for a moment to think about the following. To the extent that the systems revolve in significant part around who owns productive wealth, a system based on the institution of workers owning factories and other businesses is more likely to represent the interests of the workers than the interests of the tiny group of 400 or so who now own much of the wealth in the United States. I offer this obvious point for rumination. But quickly, also add that any serious approach to system-changing ideas needs to be very thoughtful about structural and ownership relationships. As noted, at one point the Youngstown effort focused also on a joint community-worker partnership, following the idea that the interests of the whole community, not just the steelworkers of one particular plant, were at stake. And the Cleveland effort, along, as we shall see, with many others, offers further ways to think about this broader idea, about many different ways to democratize ownership, and about the logical community building and other relationships involved in systemic design. Footnote, see the afterword for further discussion of these questions. Continuing. The tale does not end in Ohio, though. Let me take you just one or two more steps along the trajectory of the story. Many other workers' groups and many other cities around the nation have picked up on, and been inspired by, the line of development represented all too briefly in the above tale. Efforts like that in Cleveland are now being developed in Atlanta, Pittsburgh, Washington, D.C., Amarillo, Texas, and many other cities. Nor is that all. United Steelworkers, whose national leadership once opposed the Youngstown effort, has also evolved. The union has recently announced a major strategy to help build union co-op worker-owned companies around the nation. Efforts are underway, in particular, in Pittsburgh and Cincinnati. There are also signs that other unions are beginning to realize they might gain additional leverage by exploring new strategies. The Service Employees International Union is launching a worker-owned and unionized laundry project in Pittsburgh and is involved in a groundbreaking partnership with New York City's Cooperative Home Care Associates, an effort that provides home services for the elderly, chronically ill, and people living with disabilities, and is the largest worker cooperative in the United States. And the United Food and Commercial Workers Union and Homeland Acquisition Corporation, an Oklahoma and Texas-based grocery chain, have joined together to transform the company into a 100% employee-owned business. Also, lots of people are suddenly talking about the Mondragon Corporation, a spectacular 83,000-person growing grouping of worker-owned cooperatives in Spain's Basque region that is teaching the world how to move this idea into high gear and large scale. The first Mondragon Cooperative dates from 1956, and the overall effort has evolved over the years into a federation of more than 100 cooperatives, all based on the one worker, one vote principle. The Modern Steelworkers effort is a joint project undertaken with Mondragon, and the Cleveland co-ops have drawn on many of the Mondragon principles, particularly in connection with revolving loan funds to help incubate new co-ops. Again, some of the nation's business schools are now offering courses on worker ownership and other democratized business structures that they never offered before. And by the way, speaking as something of an old-timer who has been concerned with this kind of thing for longer than I care to mention, there are lots and lots of ordinary people who are now beginning to get very serious about changing ownership and about this as an idea whose time has come, or might come if we get serious. It's important to note, too, that support for worker ownership doesn't necessarily always sway left or right. Take a guess at who said this as long ago as 1987. I can't help but believe that in the future we will see in the United States and throughout the Western world an increasing trend toward the next logical step, employee ownership. It is the path that befits a free people. If Ronald Reagan came to mind, you're right. So, some things to think about as we go forward. First and foremost, If you want to play the system-changing game, don't look only to short-term, quickie answers. Yes, answers are important in the here and now, very important. But if the system is the problem, the truth is that there will not be satisfactory answers in the here and now for lots of people. That is one of the painful ways you know the problem is systemic. Which means that either you build forward no matter what, or you lose, period. Second, it is by no means obvious that a longer developmental path is inevitably blocked if you are very serious and roll up your sleeves. Third, and this is really worth your time and thought, Ohio has for more than 3 decades been experiencing the kind of economic pain other parts of the nation are now just beginning to experience. In Ohio, and now elsewhere, it is in large part precisely because none of the traditional solutions offers answers to the problems and the pain that people are forced to develop new ways. It's either that or continue to experience the pain. Fourth, and critically, note carefully that we are talking here about developing institutions, not just trying to change policy. And the institutions we are talking about directly concerned with the critical system of question of who owns and how to democratize productive wealth. If you think I am telling you this story and underlining the above logic because there is a possibility that ongoing stalemate, stagnation, and economic pain may continue in other parts of the nation, forcing choices and potentially incubating new processes, maybe even bolt by bolt system-changing strategies, you're right. But of course, that is by no means inevitable. Nor is the tale told so far the only process to think about. To be continued.